Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Forever Dog.
On today's episode of Weekend at Bergman's, we return to the glory days of cyberpunk and hacking into the system. A simpler time when the teenagers of this country bopped their gelled butt cuts to the sounds of White Zombie and Prodigy. As William Wordsworth said of the French Revolution, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." Representing the art house, it's Darren Aronofsky's first feature film, Pi, which came out in 1998. And representing the mainstream, it's 1999 super smash hit directed by the Wachowski sisters, The Matrix. Joe, are you ready?
Oh, hell yeah, Brett.
Then roll that theme song.
Well, you just jump right in. Maybe you could... Oh, you can get last week's and just kind of put it
you all know it
podcast.
Every week, you and I watch two movies together. Well, not quite together, because we watch them apart. You at your house and me at mine. Whoa, every week, we watch the same two movies. It's like taking the red pill and the blue pill. But how do we choose these two movies? Well, one is a brilliant, beautiful work of cinematic art, the height of the medium. And the other one is mainstream. I'm talking popcorn, baby. It's The Matrix, you know it. But what happens when we watch them back to back and have to say which one we liked better, and we have to be honest. Welcome to Weekend at Bergman's. We're going to watch an art house movie and a mainstream movie, and we're going to tell you which one we like better. And the one that we like better is going to go into the canon, and the one that we did not like as much is going to go into the trash canon, and we're never allowed to watch it again for the rest of our stinking lives. That's right. The premise of this podcast. My name is Brett Boehm. I'm seated across from my co-host, Joe Cilio.
Brett, we're back. Weekend at fucking Bergman's.
Oh, we're back, baby!
Bang, 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 bang. Brett, why do you have a drill?
Well, you'll have to find out when we talk about Pi. He drills into his skull at the end because he can't take the numbers.
Does that kill him?
Hey, Joe, remember about an hour ago when acclaimed actor Steven Root wandered into our studio off of the street?
Of course.
What a thrill.
It was the best part.
What a thrill.
I say this with no question. It was the best part of my day. Because I'm sitting in the engineer room, and out of the corner of my eye, I'm like, that's... Steven Root.
You knew immediately. He was wearing a mask. God bless.
Yeah, Steven Root. Shrouded in darkness.
Black shirt, black mask.
Yep.
I was in the engineering room with you. Yep. I heard someone come in.
Yep.
Who's that? We're not expecting anybody.
Yeah, what the fuck?
You lean your head out of the hallway.
Like,
he goes, hello. And I go, that voice. That distinct voice.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then I hear you say, oh, hey, how's it going?
Yeah.
As though you knew the person. And then he approaches you, and he enters. I see him enter the door frame. Even with the mask on, I knew immediately. You knew immediately.
Of course.
That's Steven Root, baby.
What do you see? Come
That's
on.
Steven Root.
We know Root. If
That's
we know
Steven
one thing,
Root.
We know Root. Now, look.
Yeah.
Lots of exciting people. We're blessed. Lots of exciting people
every
come
day.
To all of our great shows
every
here
day.
At Forever Dog Productions. Just this week, we have the great John Daly. We have, you know, Mary from Selling Sunset. Just stars on
Come
stars
on.
On stars. Come on.
John Daly's album, but, Ding Dong Delicious, out now.
But when Steven, fucking Root enters the building,
yeah.
That's a completely And John and Mary from Selling Sunset would agree. That's another level, baby. Steven Root, come
another,
on.
That's another level. That's another level.
Pay your respects. Now, what was he doing here?
Barry this season, incredible.
Come on, Barry.
He crushes.
Come on, Steven Root.
So Steven Root, this is an exclusive. Don't tell anybody we told you, because I don't think I'm supposed to say this, but Steven Root is going to be on an upcoming episode of Household Faces.
Wow.
Household Faces, wow. The acclaimed podcast hosted by John Ross Bowie, wow. Where a character actor interviews other character actors.
Yep, great podcast.
If you like movies, TV, as much as we do, and of course you do if you're listening to this podcast, one of the best shows out there right now, Household Faces. Bowie is an incredible interviewer. He gets incredible guests like Steven Root. So Steven Root's going to be on an upcoming episode of Household Faces. Look out for that. He got the day wrong. He came in on the wrong day.
Steven came in on the wrong day. No problem. LOL. He came in. He was so nice. He sat down with us. He asked a couple questions. We quickly deduced what the issue was.
Yes.
The issue being he wasn't supposed to be here.
He was supposed to be somewhere else.
He went somewhere else, but tomorrow morning he is going to come back.
Jumbo's clown room.
But this will be out by this morning. He came back. What? Hey, come on.
No,
Sorry. No, and he'll be back here. This will be out by then, and he'll be long gone. So don't come looking for Steven Root, you freaks.
Yeah, don't.
But anyway, the thrill of a lifetime, and we've been lucky enough
what
to meet
a thrill.
Just wonderful
what
people at all time.
There was
Steven
a moment.
Root.
There was a moment too where he sat down, started thumbing through his Google Cal, trying to get a handle on what had happened.
Yep.
And Joe and I looked at each other, and we were like, "Are we just gonna get to like hang out with Steven Root?"
I thought we were about to hang out,
and then
I thought he was gonna
like,
be like
immediately left when he figured out what had happened.
He said goodbye, but he said goodbye as he ran out the door.
Because he's late for happy hour jumbos.
He had an important meeting in Hollywood, California, for real.
He did.
He's Steven Root.
He's Steven Root. What do you think? He's just hanging out at Griffith Park?
Not Raising Root, the band. Steven Root, the actor.
Wait, Twisted Root? No, Rusted Root.
Rusted Root. Not.
We both got it wrong.
What did I say?
You said Raising Root, which sounds like a Fox sitcom.
And not
circa.
I Am Groot. No. And not I Am Groot. That's on Disney Plus. Steven Root, the
Twisted.
Actor, he came in and he said,
Twisted. What was it?
It's
Rusted Root.
He came in.
Send me on my way.
Send me on my way. And we will.
Send me on my
yes,
way.
Yes,
we did
yes,
send
yes,
Root
yes.
on his way.
We will watch Ice Age on the show. Anyway, so we're telling you a story about how Steven Root came into our building. He sat down, he was lost, and then a minute later he left and nothing happened. But the Weekend of Bergman fans know that is a story, and that was the best part of our day, and that rules. Because sometimes you just have to bend knee and kiss ring, and Steven Root, I am a humongous fan. It is so cool, and I'm excited to see him again tomorrow morning. I won't bother him. I am afraid of him because I respect him.
Here's what Root said. On my way. Gotta go on my way.
Yeah, he did say this actually.
Gotta get on my way.
Yeah.
I would like to hang out with you, but I can't. I've gotta get to
so disrespectful.
Jumbo's clown room.
Think about how many people never heard this podcast. This is the first one. They're like, oh yeah, The Matrix. You know, I'm gonna start here. This is gonna be a good one. And all they've heard so far, he did not go to Jumbo's clown room. This is disrespectful.
It's happy hour. They've got great chicken fingers.
I thought you wanted to show him respect by invoking him on this podcast. They have chicken fingers at Jumbo's?
This song feels offensive. Doesn't it feel like they're doing like a... They're doing kind of a... I don't know.
Everything in
they're
the
doing
past
a little Chet
is
Hanks
offensive.
In this. Yeah,
everything
in the
past
is offensive.
Offensive.
It feels like they're pulling a little Chet Hanks here.
I'm sure they are.
And they got away with it. God bless Rusted Roots.
They have a house. They have houses because of that song.
The two movies that we're talking about today, we're going a real specific point in time, which I'm really excited / terrified to revisit. The late 90s.
Yeah.
Years are coming to a close. He's been impeached at this point. The nation went through that whole crisis. Y2K is on the horizon now.
That
people are starting to think about Y2K. Computers, the internet, it's all happening.
Beep,
it's
bop,
all
beep,
happening.
1010.
Yes.
The future is now. Y2K is coming. And Aronofsky and the Wachowskis, they're thinking in their heads, I got to make a freaking about this, and they did. They each submitted really interesting techno,
cyber sci-fi
flicks.
Techno
Aronofsky with limited budge,
yes.
The Wachowskis with a big old budge,
ooh.
And they both put out some goodies, and we'll talk about them. I wonder which one you like more.
What are you gonna like more? What do you like more?
I gotta save it for the end of the podcast.
Okay.
Everyone listen to the theme song, right? Because we're gonna put one of them in the canon, one of them in the trash canon. The movie that goes in the trash canon can never be viewed by us ever again. And you did say that. I just want to remind everybody that at the end of this podcast, Brett and I will know whether or not we can ever watch The Matrix again or we can ever watch Pi again.
I've started to settle into that premise, and I just watch each movie as though it's the last time I'm ever going to see it. It kind of it really adds a dynamism to my watching of the movies, because I'm like, this sort of, there's stakes. This is the last time. Maybe this is the last time I ever see The Matrix. Maybe this is the last time I ever see Pi.
And by the way, you know, we only, what we do here, just to kind of like get it out there, is we're going to be honest and we just ask ourselves, which movie did you like more? Which movie was better? Just like this time when you watched it, like shoot from the hip, like just be honest. Like, was Pi better than The Matrix?
You got to be honest. You got to be honest.
Or was Matrix better than Pi? Like, but
I will say one thing that might make this true, and I want this can't influence our decision. But my wife Amy does watch The Matrix about once a month, and so that
can't influence
is,
her. But you will have to. What are you going to do if she throws it on next month and we pick Pi?
If we pick Pi and she throws it on next month, I will pie myself. Pie myself in the side of the head.
Cream pie yourself right on the side of the head,
and then surely that will cut out my vision. I would assume you going with a drill the side of the temple.
That's a mercy for you.
So let's before we get into the movies, let's go back to that Annus Mirabilis 1999, end of the century, baby, end of the century. And I want to do a little segment called Y2K is Nigh. Y2K is Nigh. Remember this?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to pull this one off. This is kind of a tricky one.
You've never pulled any of them off.
Y2K is nigh, it's nigh. Y2K is nigh, it's nigh. Oh, baby. Y2K is nigh, it's nigh, it's nigh, it's nigh. Y2K is nigh. It's the thing that everyone was talking about in 1999. And if you're not old enough to remember that, or you have conveniently forgotten it, basically everybody thought that every computer operated thing in the world was going to blow up when the clock turned to 2000. There was this thought that like the computers had not been built to accommodate numbers higher than 1999, something to that effect. That the year switched to 2000, all the computers were going to malfunction. We're talking personal computers,
planes would
ATMs,
fall out of the sky.
Planes would fall out of the sky. So literally everyone was sort of waiting, and like all these little businesses popped up, like protect yourself from Y2K.
Did your family buy stuff and put it in the basement, like canned soup and water? Did you do that?
I don't think.
I think my family like half-assed it. Like they went to Costco, they got like a thing of water and a thing of soup in case we wanted to live an extra like 2 or 3 weeks.
But there was a lot of stockpiling. There was a lot of survivalism going on. There's a lot of companies being like, you know, protect your computer from Y2K. We got the secret code to help you avoid that.
It was nigh. There's no. I think you said it well. Y2K was coming.
And what I want to do to recapture that time period is play a little game here with you, Joe.
What's the second?
I'm going to. On this, we're going to kind of do this live. And again, you can watch these. We haven't set our costumes yet either. You can watch these episodes on Forever Dog Plus. Sign up at foreverdog.plus. Mm. Why would you do that? Well, because
we're
it's just fun to
costumes.
See people do the podcast.
Well,
but
because
also,
A, people like watching video podcasts. Yes. But really, more importantly, B, we're wearing funny fucking costumes.
We're in costumes every week. Funny. We dress up like the movies. Joe is dressing in the style of the Matrix.
No, I am dressed as Neo.
It's like the Basil Rathbone version of the Matrix. You got a little puffy pirate shirt on. Cool. But it is cool. It does. You definitely would be someone that was hanging out in the club at the Matrix.
Thank you very much, but I am Neo. If I was at Halloween, one person at the party would go, what are you like, Neo?
I don't know. I see. But you'll only, with the bubble sunglasses, I would say Bono. I would kind of go Bono like that.
Speaking of Bono, I do look like, you know, one of Green Goblin's like henchmen in Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Great.
Is kind of what I would look like.
Yeah.
But anyway, you can be the judge of what I look like on foreverdog.plus.
He looks phenomenal.
Whatever you
think he looks like, it's a phenomenal look. I hope you lean into it. I hope we see it again around
thank
the
you so
office.
Much. If we do Neo, sure.
I am dressed in the spirit of the movie Pi.
Great.
I have written the first 19 numbers of Pi, the numerical, the digit Pi on my chest here.
Wow.
Of course, the famous 314, but then 159, 265, so on and so on. So you can see that. Is it coming across or is it backwards? It's backwards on here.
Oh, but I thought you were doing it. It's like because you're unhinged, like the main character of Pi.
It's
like
intentional. Max. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're unhinged.
I can see it the right way. Nobody else can see it the right way. That kind
That's
of
a really
thing.
Good match.
I also have my drill, little prop here.
Yeah. From the end of Pi.
From the end of Pi. We'll get to it.
But what about the Y2K being nigh?
What you'll also see is us kind of do this game live, which is I'm going to abbreviate the 10 biggest box office movies from 1999.
Oh, fuck.
Okay, Matrix is on that list. I'm going to abbreviate them. For each one, I'm going to abbreviate them. So go off the abbreviations, okay? You can get one hint for each movie if you want, okay? And you can also pass.
So these are the top 10 box office hits in 1999.
Here's what I'm going to do simultaneously. I'm going to play the song Dracula by Rob Zombie, which plays in the club in the Matrix when he goes to the club in the beginning.
That's fun.
Every time you pass or ask for a hint, I'm going to turn the volume of Dracula up. So if you get a bunch of hints or passes, this song's going to be pounding in your skull by the end, baby. You're going to grab for this
drill.
What
about our fans?
And then if you can get to the end, if you can get to the end of the list before Dracula ends, you win. And let's say like minimum... Let's say you get two passes. You get two passes because you can't just
I get two passes. You get two passes for a hint
every time. You have a hint every time.
But you turn it up one whole volume. There's only like 11 volumes on the computer.
Yeah, this is a tough game. I'm
scared.
If you don't get to the end by the time Dracula ends, then you lose.
I love movies, but I hope I love the top 10 movies in 1999. I guess they'll be popular enough. Hopefully. So you're going to give me the initials of them?
The initials, yes.
So if it was like The Matrix, it'd be like TM.
That's right.
That's going to be hard. All right, here we go. All right.
And I'm using green for the Matrix. Okay, so here we go. Let me start Dracula.
Look, I'm a Rob Zombie guy. You know, I like Rob Zombie a lot.
All right, here we go. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Here we go. There's Dracula. Here's the board.
Okay, all right, number one.
Number one. SW:EO/PM.
Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace.
Correct. Number two, TSS. TSS.
The Sixth Sense.
Yes. Number three, AP:TSWSM.
Hint.
Do I make you sequel, baby?
Oh, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Number four, correct. Number four, TS2.
Hint.
You've got a sequel in me.
Oh, Toy Story 2.
Number,
thank you for the hint.
Number five, TM.
The Matrix.
Number six, T.
I want it. I want it so bad. T is...
hint. He swings to the trees with the greatest demand. Number seven.
BD.
BD.
Hit me.
Oh, which one is what is that? Crap, what is BD?
Big Daddy.
Yes, you got it. You got it. Right, I'm going to go down one. Down one.
Oh, wow, okay.
Number eight, TM. TM. Not The Matrix.
Not The Matrix. It's, hint.
The best ride at Universal.
The mummy! Brandon Fraser's mummy!
Number nine, RB! RB! You got it, you almost had it!
Real?
No!
Hit! Royal!
Julie Bastards. Roberts wears tennis shoes, and she can't get away from Richard Gere fast enough, baby!
Oh, Runaway Bride!
Correct, number 10, TDWP!
Hit!
People didn't know if it was real or not. They were so scared.
Oh, the Blair Witch Project.
You did
it's a W United. Yeah. Oh, 1999 was good. I love it. We got Austin Powers. We got T. We got Runaway Bride. And we got the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, that was fun.
That
was fun. You won. You won. Congratulations. That was really well done. I don't know if I would have been able to do that.
I love that. Oh, man.
Great song. What?
There's lots of other movie podcasts you can listen to if you want to hear about the fucking movies. If you want to watch two assholes play games. This is the fucking Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show of movie podcasts.
How dare you?
What a beautiful waste of everybody's time. Thank
all
you.
Right.
That was great.
Let's get into the movies. Why don't we? We got about an hour here. We can do this. We're going to start off this week with The Matrix. Last week we started off with The Art House, so we'll switch it up. We're going to start out with The Matrix. You all know The Matrix. Came out in 1999, written and directed by Lana and Lily Wachowski, starring, first name only, please, Keanu, Larry, Carrie, Hugo, Joey Pants, baby. Budget $63 million. Box office $467 million. A little sweet profit there. Joe, go ahead and give us, before we dig into the Matrix, go ahead and give us one of your classic 60-second recaps. A 60-second recap of the Matrix. You all know it, but it doesn't hurt to review.
Sure.
And maybe he'll give us some details you weren't expecting. He said, oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
I forgot about that. Oh,
oh yeah, Neo.
That. All right. And go.
Keanu Reeves plays Neo, who's a hacker kind of a guy, and he works like a dead-end kind of job, and he knows something,
Thomas Anderson.
He knows something. And one day, he starts getting a weird message on his computer, and it turns his life upside down. Next thing you know, he's being brought by Trinity into the world of Morpheus, and the Matrix is revealed to him. He goes down the rabbit hole. He takes the red pill, and he learns that our world is a fiction, and the real world is actually us are all in little stinky little sloppy eggs that robots can come and pull our brains out. And he, and but Morpheus knows something about Neo. He knows that Neo is the one who's going to save them. And he believes in Neo. Even when Neo and everybody else doesn't believe in Neo, he believes. And you know what Neo does, folks?
10 seconds left.
He proves Morpheus freaking right. He is the one. And he has all the power. And he can do all the cool tricks. And he beats the robots. And it fucking rules.
And that's time. Really well done. Really well done. And I'm not exaggerating. That was right on the money time-wise. You can watch it on Forever Dog Plus to confirm.
Thank you.
Real quick before we get started, and I mean this literally, I don't think anyone's ever been hotter on film than Carrie Ann Moss in this movie.
Great.
Unbelievable. Checks every box.
Maybe other podcasts you'd get noted on that, but not on this one. You get a nod of the head from me.
Hot, cool, mysterious, incredible performance, using every instrument.
Yeah, she's the best.
Face, the action sequences.
She's fucking cool.
Carrie Moss in this movie as Trinity, I just think is one of the sexiest performance of all time.
Hell yeah, now we're talking. Couldn't agree more.
Doesn't mean I'm going to pick the Matrix over Pi.
No, you're just saying that Carrie Moss knocks it out of the park.
Knocks it out of the park. But specifically, just dead sexy. Yeah. I just am blown away.
Now, what do you think about Keanu Reeves' sexiness level in the Matrix? I'll start. He's been sexier.
He has. It's important to note that he has been sexier.
And he's been insanely sexy.
Yes.
And he is insanely sexy. But I just...
Because you got My Own Private Idaho, you got John Wick, you have a lot of... So it's not like if this was the only thing we had, oh yeah, sexy. But I'm comparing to other Keanos. And
No.
Honestly, middle of the pack. Middle of the pack.
Maybe, yeah. What I will say is that the Wachowskis and their team... They like adorn him with some of the most iconic and funny costume pieces that make him, you know, so cool. And that part at the end when he's officially fully on board with him being the one and he bursts through the security system, he blows up a million cops and he has like a million guns. And it's just like a gun city. And he and Trinity, and they're just like glass and blonde, and like it's just noise, and then all the way through the end when he's just like kicking ass and wearing those hilarious little glasses with our little ovals that like kind of tilt up. It's not men's fashion, it's not woman's fashion, it's not androgynous fashion, it's nobody's fashion, it's Neo's fashion, and it works. And he flies away at the end, and I said to myself, God, Keanu's sexy.
There's so much,
God, Keanu's
there's so
sexy.
Much style for style's sake in this movie, and I love it. There is like there's leather, there's the agents in the black and white suits with the black glasses. Everything is so stylized.
I'm sorry. I'm not done. Real quick before. I'm so sorry.
I got a Keanu sexy thing too.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Oh, great. I just wanted to just quickly note that Hugo Weaving is scary and sexy.
Yeah.
Lawrence Fishburne is confident and sexy in this film. He looks good.
And Hugo Weaving pushes every word out of his mouth.
All right, good. I wanted to just quickly make sure everybody was on board that the sexiness is strewn throughout this film.
Push the words.
There's a moment where Keanu wakes up. He wakes up in the like robot hell, right? Where he's like
the real world.
I was just taken over by robots, and all the humans are in little like liquid pods, and they got all these cables connected to them because they're being harvested for energy.
It looks so good, even after all these years.
And then he gets out of it, and he's like gets like thrown down this like sewer tube, and then he comes out the sewer tube. And there's a brief shot where like naked Keanu comes out of the sewer tube at the bottom. And my wife and I both had the same idea. Again, my wife watches this every month. But we both had the same thought together because I was like, watch this with new eyes with me. Let's like kind of think of new things, new impressions. Like, let's act like we've never seen it before. And we both turned to each other and we're like, did we just get Keanu dick? Did we get Keanu dick in that little shot?
Do we?
Here's the thing. So we went back frame by frame, and we do not, because I'm going to show this. I screenshot. I'm going to show this to
we
in
know
camera.
if we did by now, yes. I suppose. Okay, yeah, let's see it.
There's
this
a little
is, this
loin,
is good.
There's a little loincloth. He's got a little, see that little loincloth he's got on?
I can't even like decipher like
it's like a little
where's his head? Oh, he's falling.
He's
out.
Coming out of the tube.
He's got I see it.
It's a little hammock.
Yeah, he's got a little tiny
like loincloth hammock. Uh-huh. But it's not, I don't think this is in the world of the movie. I think this is like a prop, like a movie like hot like prop to hide his junk. I don't think this is like canonical for the world of the film that all these like that all these humans are wearing little
shields
hammocks. And once again, you can see this on
maybe they are
Fairy
maybe
Dog
maybe
Plus.
It's, maybe like some Matrix fans would be like, no, like they don't have reproductive organs because they're all grown intravenously in the pod.
You could
like
easily they do make it look
they
like
that.
They didn't
you
make
know,
it
so
like
there is no.
They do sort of age it up a little bit and sort of like make it a little gritty for the world of the real world. But no, that was just like Keanu was like, I'm not doing full frontal. And they're like, got it. And then they put also yeah. like and it's also not Keanu. It's definitely a stunt double.
Sure.
And also like maybe like there was an issue with like him coming out of the tube and like having stuff fly around. So it was like a protection, like a safety issue. But that is not a canonical. That's not in the world of the movie. If I
was a betting man, and I am, I would bet that somebody's validated like it's canon because they realized they fucked up and then they made it canon. One of those things. That's just a pure gamble, folks. You can look it up on the phone that you have.
This movie is phenomenal. This movie to me is reminds me a lot of our conversation of Die Hard, of just an absolutely one of the hardest movies to make, which is a big budget mainstream movie with a lot of anticipation behind it, and you nail it. And you nail it for every type of audience. You nail it for incels love it. Tim Pool loves it. But then
we
like cool
it.
People love
yeah,
it.
Okay.
We love it.
Yeah,
everybody from the good to the bad in American
the dads
culture.
Love it.
The dads
the
love it.
The daughters love it.
They
the
love it.
The grandpas
love
it.
They love it. My wife loves it. Everybody loves this movie, and it's a weird movie. And they did a weird movie that has undeniable mainstream popularity across the board. I wanted to look at why that is, because I think the ultimate answer to me, the answer, stylization, yes, style. The surface of this movie is so beautiful and interesting in every frame. They do the Blade Runner thing of kind of sci-fi meets noir, which is one of my favorite genre mashups when sci-fi and noir come together. And it's sci-fi, but it's in like a city and it's dark and it's dank and there's rain and there's alleys and there's fire escapes and that kind of a world. But beneath that, to me, the reason this movie is so good is just some very fundamental things they do with storytelling. This is one of the best examples of cinematic storytelling I think that's ever come out of mainstream Hollywood. Let's start with just the opening scene of Trinity fighting her way out of the building.
Oh, hell yeah.
Let's start with that.
Can't wait.
And we'll kind of talk about how this movie's skills at storytelling. All right. So we got it's sort of a murky hallway, and there's police officers, and they're coming down to the end of this hallway. There's weird little roots and cables and wires everywhere. They come to a door, 303, a palindrome. It's all about the numbers, baby. That guy kicks it open. You see a single figure with black leather seated at a table.
Oh,
reverse
shit.
Shot to Trinity's face. Her hands go up. Now we go to the outside of the hotel. Heart of the City Hotel. Cool little, like, noir touch. Like an old, like, Robert Mitchum film or something. He'd be at Heart of the City Hotel.
Shannon.
Yeah, that's good, Robert. I was going to say it's like a American Horror Story
Shannon,
hotel.
Oh, I like that, yeah. The agents show up.
Hey, I'm just doing my job.
But it's not really
give me
like that
jurist my diction crap. You can cram it up your ass.
We'll talk about this in a
famous,
second.
Famous cop stuff.
Yeah, we'll talk about this in a second, but
I think we can handle one little
terrible dialogue in this movie, and it
what?
Doesn't matter. It doesn't. I will argue. I will argue.
Yeah,
I will argue for that.
We'll
almost
that.
Makes it better, but like undeniably
a
silly, bad dialogue.
Your men are already dead.
That's a good line.
Yeah, there are some
good
winners.
Lines.
There are some
but,
winners, though.
Yeah, there are some real winners. All right, they approach Trinity from behind.
Oh,
now,
fuck. Oh,
Trinity.
Oh, Trinity's
the cop's arm.
Oh, fuck. Kills him, beating up a cop.
Now, she does some
wop
at some, what's called wire
bang.
Foo, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Oh, chair. Oh, she's running on the wall. It's awesome.
Running on the wall.
I'm completely and totally bought in. Oh, this rules. Oh.
Just immediately one of the best action sequences anybody had ever seen at this point.
That is so cool. I mean, I just watched this movie for like the 10th time yesterday.
And nothing that feels like CGI. Everything this movie feels like it's really happening. There's never that moment where it switches and you're like, oh, that's not real. That's digital. Everything feels analog in the world. And mystery. Something. We got to catch up to what's happening. What's happening? She's talking on the phone. She's got something's happening. Who's she talking to? Go. They always make you catch up in this movie to what's happening, which I love. All right. Now she's being chased by the agents. So she's like, she's scared by them. So you're like, oh, those guys must be the real deal.
Loving the score.
So much plot just implied by action, implied by responses. Efficient storytelling.
She's jumping
over the roofs.
Oh, cops are jumping over roofs too. Wait a second.
They barely make it though. But here comes the big roof.
Oh, she's no way she can jump over this roof.
And they're gonna switch to an aerial shot here.
Oh man, I love it. I love those two shots. The tracking across the roof.
Sound of it. The sound
so
of
good.
Them going up and over the.
Oh,
and here we go.
Big jump. Wait, that's not a human.
Aerial shot of her jumping over the street to the next building.
But wait.
It's impossible.
Hugo Weaving can also jump. Is that Hugo Weaving? No,
it's Hugo's guys.
It's one of those guys. One of his henchmen.
And this incredibly gifted, supernaturally gifted woman is afraid, though. So we know that there is danger. She is in danger, despite her abilities. She flies across the street, through the window of the next building, tumbles down the stairs, lands on her back, right away bounces back up with two guns pointed at the window. Oh, and she looks so cool and so hot all the time in this movie.
Get up, Trinity. Just get up. Get up.
People talk to themselves a lot in this movie.
Fine by me.
And now she's...
Think of all she's been through.
She sees a telephone booth, which is what the person on the phone told her. This big truck comes along.
Big,
I'm just
scary
narrating
truck.
The most like one of the most iconic scenes of The Matrix. You all know what's happening.
Whatever. The truck. It's going right towards the photo booth.
She gets in the phone booth. She picks up the phone. She holds out her hand. Truck crushes the phone booth. But surely not Trinity. Surely Trinity wasn't just run down by a semi truck driven by Agent Smith. He comes upon the
rubble.
And
then this is when he says, Mr. Anderson. Right? Is it now? Or maybe he says Mr. Anderson later.
He doesn't say Mr. Anderson right now.
No, I'm just kidding.
Shit.
I know.
I'm sorry. I'm so into this. I can't decipher humor right now.
The name is Neo.
Neo.
The search running has already begun.
Oh, you mean... Mr. Anderson.
There you go. It's implied. They pan over the rubble into the phone.
And then the numbers, baby. The green
numbers.
Oh, it's in the computer.
Switch to Neo's computer.
All right. Honestly, that scene was awesome. God, that was good. And
on
if
the
you,
transition
and,
to
and
Neo.
Have,
okay, all right. We got to talk about this.
If you have Forever Dog Plus, and then you could have watched it, you know.
That was so cool. Yeah. I honestly don't know if we need to watch. Like, there's all these other iconic scenes, obviously, in the movie. Everything I want to say is in that scene.
Tell me about
it. Okay. First of all, incredibly, the pacing. This time I watched it, I was like, what is the, I'm like Neo, I'm like Max and Pi. I'm trying to get to the bottom of this whole code. What made The Matrix so good, right? What makes The Matrix so good? I think maybe more fundamental than anything is the pacing of the movie. The movie is expertly paced. And in every scene, I'm a little out of breath. We don't have an engineer today, so I'm going back and forth between the engineering booth and the recording room. So every scene, they strike this incredible balance in terms of the information they're giving you, where they give you just enough information to know what's going on in the scene, to know the stakes of the scene. Even if you don't know the context of the stakes, you know scene by scene what the stakes are. And the stakes are always as simple as someone's trying to get away from someone else, someone's trying to find out something, someone's trying to get in somewhere. You always know enough to know what the stakes of the scene are. But they also So they give you just enough information to know what's going on, and then they give you they take away enough information to maximize the mystery and suspense of the scene. And there's this incredible balance. So in that scene, we know that the police and then this sort of shadowy, perhaps governmental or something organization wants to arrest and capture Trinity. We know that Trinity wants to get away from them. We know that she has these incredible skills. We don't know how or why, though. But you can just sort of bask in the beauty of her athleticism and powers being displayed to you without knowing where they come from. So there's two things happening where you love what you're seeing and you get instinctively what you're seeing, but then there's all these questions that are happening in your head. Why? How? Is it real? Is it not real? And then the call from Morpheus that she gets also exquisitely hits that balance of like, you know what the stakes are. She's got to get to the phone booth, right? Simple. Yeah. Get to the phone booth. But who's on the other line? Why the phone booth? What happens in the phone booth? What does this world consist of? The mistakes that the sequels make are incredibly absent here. When the sequels, I think all sequels do this. They get so bogged, they get so full of themselves, and then it becomes all about world building and the Easter eggs and the density of the world and the history of the world.
Yeah.
All of that is just blissfully absent in this movie. There is honestly, there's much less world building than I thought there was going to be because the world has become so iconic. Red pill, blue pill, the Matrix, the robots, Zion, all this stuff. But it's that information is given to you. You don't get more than you need, and you also don't get enough to feel like I get it. You get enough so that you can follow what's going on, but also a little enough that there's this constant air of mystery and suspense in the movie as to what's going on. And it makes you, this is a movie that just constantly makes you sit forward and go, what? What? Oh, okay. Oh boy. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Constantly making those noises during the movie. I love it. Expert cinematic storytelling.
I think, you know, the script, you know, it follows the perfect, I don't know, whatever, like hero's journey, like, yeah. or the perfect act, the perfect structure of a film, you know, Neo's, you know, the new world's revealed and then he's reborn and then, you know, all those, and then he becomes the one. And, you know, it's one of those, you know, Joseph Campbell stories in a lot of ways, but okay, great. I mean, people try that all the time and fail. This movie does not fail at all. In fact, it's one of the most just like blissful, like endorsements of that kind of storytelling that I've ever seen.
This is the Star Wars of the 90s. This is, I think, the Star Wars of the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This about world building, I thought that this, you didn't feel like it was taking time to world build because the world is so expertly unfurled to us throughout the movie. But that world is exciting, interesting, and rich. And why this movie works so well, I believe, is twofold. One, that the concept of we do not live in the real world. This is a simulation. You know, that is very potent. And it probably was at the birth of this technology. It was by 1999. And it still is today. That is a very exciting and interesting proposal for your movie to posit. And then to expertly unfurl such a cool vision of what that means and how, you know, this team of people are going to team up to fight it and save us is so arresting. And then the second storytelling element beyond, you know, perfect structure, wonderful characters, expertly unfurled world is what you're getting at about this sort of it pulling you along the whole entire time. It reminds me of something I read once about why this isn't a dig, it's true, why the works of Dan Brown are winners every single time.
Tell me.
Because Dan Brown at the end of every chapter does two things. He serves you up a mystery that you're like, wait, what? So you kind of want to see what happens next. But also there's a thing in Dan Brown novels that I think's at work here where you think in, like, not like it's, you know, but you think in your head a little bit that you can crack the code or solve know where it's going or figure it out. And this movie and Pi both really, really play on that. And that's sort of at its core what's so beautiful about this and what's so potent about conspiracy theories. Now that's so loaded and so horrifying. But they've always been so enjoyable and you want to hear about conspiracy theories and they always seem so true because like there's something about the Matrix that rings kind of true. What is wrong with our world? Why is deja vu exist? Why do the basketball players all stand up the same way? Why is like, is this it? Is this real? And then there's articles that flip through your phone that's like, no, no, it really is a simulation. Like, that's science. You know, there's like these kinds of things always coming in. So when the Matrix just like, it just hits you. It's just like, oh, wait, like, that's why it's so red pill, blue pill. That's why this is so iconic. This lexicon that was built for this film is so potent and today is so used because it just rings so, so true.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, though, because I was wondering, too, while I was watching it, if it would play the same today as it did in 1999. And I think the storytelling, there's a lot of things about that are just universal and timeless. Like you said, hero's journey kind of archetypes. Just expert cinematic storytelling. The special effects are surprisingly not dated, I think, because they didn't lean on like late 90s CGI, which would have made it feel dated, but did a lot of things. This is also, I call this the Star Wars of the 90s. It's also, I think you could argue in one specific way, the Citizen Kane of the 90s, in the sense that they were, and movies don't do this anymore because you can lean so heavily on CGI and post-production. But they like physically were inventing analog style effects for the movie. Just like Orson Welles when he's making Citizen Kane was like, I need the entire shot to be in focus like 100 yards. And Greg Toland was like, that doesn't exist. And he's like, make it your problem. And then Greg Toland goes, okay, and goes back to his library and like invents a deep focus lens. And then you can have the entire mansion, you know, in focus in Citizen Kane. They're literally inventing, he's tearing up the floor so he can get the lowest angle shot possible. They're inventing things as they go along. And for the Matrix, the Wachowskis invented, the iconic shot at the end of the bullets slowing down. They're sort of utilizing some older effects and older things here that have been around, but combining them together and invented something that's now called bullet time, in which the way they achieve that shot, and you know the shot where Neo slows the bullets down and this and that.
Yeah, but I want to know how they did it.
It is the heightened perception of certain characters called bullet time. In the Matrix, it's meant to, you know, when a character achieves this higher level of consciousness, right, is when they bring in the bullet time effect. And it's represented by allowing the action within the shot to progress in slow motion while the camera appears to move through the scene at normal speed, allowing the sped up movements of certain characters to be perceived normally. So they're playing around with slow motion, real time. I don't know. I wish I knew more about it, the engineering and the mechanics of it than that. But that's all I know. But they were inventing this as they went along in conjunction with their DP, with their team. They did not invent this, but they sort of brought it into mainstream American filmmaking, which is what's called wire foo, which is that like we just saw there. It was very popular in martial arts movies where by using a series of wires and harnesses, you're doing martial arts in such a way that people are sort of floating, appearing to float, running along walls as though they have supernatural abilities. So that's something they borrowed from
a lot of
martial arts filmmaking, but brought it into mainstream American filmmaking. But they're asking all the questions they're trying to solve in this movie mechanically. They are trying to come up with analog answers, like, you know, stuff that we can actually do and film, not just like, well, this is not just we'll fix it in post. This is the ultimate argument against we'll fix it in post mentality. It's like, figure out how to do it in the movie.
That always brings out the best in limitations or invention, always brings out the best in the best filmmakers. And I'm not surprised to hear that they went above and beyond to get the effects exactly like they had it in their head. And they are awesome, gorgeous. All the CGI looks so good. In the 90s, CGI was so much better than it is today. I think because what you're saying is like it was just part of it.
It wasn't relied on. Not even a crutch. Now it's just like
– now it's ubiquitous. It's every shot. It's every single thing.
When how many times do you see like a photograph from the set of House of Gucci and they're like in front of a green screen. I'm like, what the fuck are we doing? Film House of Gucci. Just go to the
locations. Film House of Gucci.
Just film House of Gucci.
Just go to fucking Gucci's house and film.
What are you doing?
I agree.
So they just, now it's just, it's just the, yeah, but anyway.
I agree.
And Matrix also has that fun thing that you don't hear about anymore where like some of the sets were left over from older movies and were lying around. I love those stories. The roof, I think that what we just watched, the Heart of the City Hotel, the roofs that Trinity was running over were left over from Dark City, a movie with a very similar style. Maybe we'll watch it at some point on Weekend at Bergman's. Very similar style and aesthetic. A little more of just a straight up fantasy movie, but very similar in a lot of ways. That's not true. Very similar across the board, Dark City, to The Matrix. There are a lot of movies in the late 90s that had this look and feel. Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days from earlier in the 90s, The Lawnmower Man. I saw people sort of drawing connections with this in The Truman Show. There's a lot of interest in
Pie.
Pie, of course. There's a lot of interest in, like you said, illusion and artifice. This world that we're in is a simulation, it's not the real world.
That's a good hook for your original IP.
I want to return, though, to my thought about how this would play now. I think...
Yeah, well, now's a different time, isn't it?
There is such a... It was such a moment in the late 90s. And I recently read something that the musician, famous musician and producer Steve Albini wrote on Twitter about kind of like the edgelord era in the late 90s where we kind of thought we had... solved a lot of problems that we hadn't solved. And we kind of thought, and so suddenly there was this like vacuum where we're like, where I think a lot of particularly white people in America were like, well, racism's not a thing anymore. Sexism's not a thing anymore. We're starting to get the beginnings of gay rights. Everybody was like, we're figuring it out. You're like, we watched The Real World. We get it. Everything's kind of fine now. And so
watched The Real World. So you're saying they went through the Clinton trial and The Real World and everybody was looking at each other going, we figured it out. You're not wrong. I'm just saying
foolishly.
That's what you're saying.
Because the question I'm trying to answer is like, why was there this sort of mental space for people to like go so hard at like sci-fi problems in the late 90s? Like there was this like, you know, like people literally had can you imagine having the mental space now to be like, yeah, but the real issue is like, is this all a simulation or is it not like now okay. it's, you know, we are, you know, whatever, I don't want to get to it. But like post-Trump, we're submerged back in all of the kind of ancient enduring wounds of American history that were always there. But there was this brief time, I think, in the late 90s where particularly the sort of edgelord culture was like, we did all that. We solved like social problems and civil rights and everything.
Now we're in the
now we can get into the future.
We're in the computer problems.
We can get into the future problems.
Gotta worry about the robots.
Ooh, we gotta worry about the robots and the code problems. And the numbers and all that. And like there's that scene where Neo is being interrogated by Agent Smith and he's like,
oh, it's scary. He's
got the mouth. Stop this Gestapo crap, dude. And he's giving him the finger. Yeah. And it's like that mentality of like, this is the real problem. It's like us versus
the suits.
So it's
skateboard,
so funny.
Punk rock, jackass, 90s kids all grew up and got a computer.
And it seemed cool, and it's kind of fun to recover what it was like in the 90s, but the world has become so inverted that now that mentality is almost exclusively the mentality of the far right, which is why red pilling and all that, why the far right kind of recycled a lot of these terms as their own, much like they've co-opted so many things. And so that's why I'm wondering if this plays... Like I watched it and I was like, I love it. I can watch this as just pure cinema out of time and space and just love it because the storytelling is so solid.
Okay.
But I was also in my head, like if this came out today, the audience for this would be like, incels and 8chan, like far right dweebs. And
I'm listening and loving. I'm thinking
too as I'm saying it. I don't know what any of this. None of this ultimately affects my viewing of the movie. Because the other thing to say is that obviously directed by the Wachowski sisters, two trans women filmmakers, directed by two very progressive people, two people who are we're at the forefront of a lot of things. And I'm sure are not much like the creator of Pepe the Frog. I'm sure are not like overjoyed by the use of red pilling on like in like certain corners of Reddit. So there's just a lot. There's like a perfect pure movie, and then there's all this like shit around it, and I don't know what to do with all the shit around it. I don't know what to make of that.
Oh, I'll tell you what I'll do with all the shit around it. consider it and think about it and know it exists. But like, as far as judging the movie goes, like the movie had nothing to do with any of that.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Nothing.
It doesn't affect
it. So the movie is great. About if the movie came out today is always interesting, because like they wouldn't come out today because we have a whole host of different concerns, and the Wachowskis are onto their a whole other host of problems and ideas and cool movies they're trying to get made and stuff. But what this movie, another way to say it, which is like a weaker, less interesting way to say it, is this movie is a 1999 movie. It makes sense coming out in 1999. I know what you're getting at with the now is the violence too? It's not like too violent. Like I don't believe, you know, it's not. We make violent movies now. I think if the movie came out now, I think that it would not be as good because they'd make them put a lot more CGI in it. Though,
no,
thing.
Of course, yeah.
But I think The Matrix would play.
Yeah.
Because people love conspiracy theories. The computer in the future are still scary. The performances, those actors would still murder it. Oh, wait, Brett, it's so funny.
Yeah.
They made a Matrix movie like 6 months
very
ago.
Very recently.
And it fucking stunk.
It was bad.
Or it stunk really bad. It didn't fucking stink. It stunk really bad. So they made a Matrix.
And because they got Bob, now, they're so...
But if Matrix came out fresh today, I wonder if anybody would have an appetite for an original sci-fi IP story. And I guess we can eke out one every 2 years that'll like kind of hit.
Yeah.
But if we did have attention and appetite for an original piece of IP, this one would win because it's classic in its structure. It's perfect in its execution. The performances are vivid and compelling. And the core sort of tension between where we are now and the future and our lives, like this can't be how it is, right? Would still all hit. I think that if Matrix came out today, it would be a big fat hit because The Matrix is an excellent, excellent movie. And maybe I'm just totally,
the filmmaking.
It's just so good, man. It's just clean as hell.
Yeah.
It works. It's exciting. It builds correctly. It has awesome, iconic scenes. You mentioned Die Hard already. When we watched Die Hard, we talked about the part when McClane drops the computer with the bomb down the elevator shaft and blows up the thing, and it's so great. And this movie has another thing that really just lit my soul on fire, and I hope all of you, I'm sure it did because it's the end of The Matrix, but the part when the helicopter is falling out of the sky,
come on,
and Neo
come
grabs
on.
That rope, and he gets shuffled down to the edge of the building, and he puts his feet and holds true, and you're like, wow, Neo, is he going to like pick up a helicopter? He's so strong. And it's like, no, he just knows and trusts that Trinity is smart enough to unhook that rope and the helicopter will fall and she will remain and he can save her. And then Morpheus walks up behind him and Morpheus is like, you're the one, man. I told you. I freaking told you. And Neo's like, I am the one. That is awesome. It totally works. And it would work today because that sort of like heartfelt, well-told story plays today. I know it because I just saw Top Gun Maverick in the movie theater this weekend.
And I believe we're going to release a little special episode where you talk about
folks.
Top
I'm
Gun
doing
Maverick.
A new thing. I'm really excited about Weekend at Bergman's. Every once in a while, I can't help but treat myself to a double feature over at the AMC and Universal. And this weekend I went, and boy, oh boy, I had a great time at the movies.
What'd you see?
I saw Top Gun Maverick. And after that, I saw Cronenberg's Crimes of the Future.
Wow.
They were great. And I just want listeners to know that the episode after this is going to be a little bonus. If you care to join me, I'm doing a mini Weekend at Bergman's, just me solo, kind of hashing out those two films. And yeah, I put one in the canon. I put one in the trash cannon.
Oh my God, you did. Oh my God. Okay, so that's going to be dropping between episodes. So maybe
the next episode in your feed, check
weekend,
it out.
Maybe
I'd love if you checked
week,
it out.
Yeah.
Every once in a while,
we'll drop it between episodes.
I love a double feature, folks. So check out double feature. But anyway, the point is that in Top Gun Maverick, when well-executed people that know how to make big-budget films execute correctly and they play on your heartstrings and they understand how things build and how heroes work and what affects the audience that they play, I think that the violence at the end of The Matrix is cool AF. It's not particularly – like, you know, we all like – the horrible thing happened, and then we all watched Stranger Things, where it's all about horrible thing happening. And then we all watched, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi, which they had to put a little thing up for lesser reasons, but a bunch, you know. What I'm saying is that, like, there's violence and shit all the time everywhere on Netflix and on Disney Plus and Star Wars and Stranger Things. If The Matrix came out today, nobody would blink. I think it would get a great reception because it is a great film.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, it's the same for any – this is, again, pure cinema, cinematic storytelling. if we can't have the Matrix without all going out and shooting each other, if you really think that things are correlated,
nothing,
then there's deeper
nothing,
fucking
nothing
problems,
to do with
people, and it's called fucking guns.
Nothing,
called,
nothing to do with anything. Obviously, the Matrix rules. I watched the Matrix.
It's a movie, and it
you
rules.
Know, I
did.
I got up and I made dinner for my fucking family, and I sat down and I said, God, I'm hungry from watching a great film.
Great movie. I think it would play the same today.
I'd hope so.
Because again,
or
pure,
we're just totally lost.
No, because I think it is just such a pure exercise in again, cinematic storytelling. Every week I have a word I can't stop repeating. And this week, cinematic storytelling, that's what the Matrix is. It is storytelling through action, through visuals. Ugh. Again, I'll go back to it. I think there are some iconic lines. I found the dialogue very cheesy on this view, and it guess what? It didn't fucking matter. If anything, it made it better.
The things don't matter. The fact that the future didn't turn out anything like what the Matrix is suggesting
doesn't matter.
I didn't even think about that until like 2 days later. You know, when I see the Matrix, maybe because it's so in the collective unconscious, essentially the Matrix, like the green code falling down the thing, the cell phones, the trench coats, you know, the glasses, the hair. All of it's so just ingrained, but nothing in the Matrix bothered me. And I'm going to include the writing in that. You're right. I guess the writing wasn't good.
Did not
think about it for one second.
There's a scene where Keanu early on is trying to escape from the agents in the office, and Morpheus is guiding him on the phone, telling him where to go. Mm-hmm. Right. And then there's a point where he's in the office, and then Morpheus wants him to go out on the ledge, right? And like, and he ends up not doing it.
I'm not doing
that. But there's a scene where he's alone in the office, and it's like there's several lines of dialogue in a row. He's alone. He's talking to himself, and he goes like, he's like, what am I doing? Oh, this is crazy. What are you doing? Why am I doing this? Oh, no, I can't do this. Oh, this is crazy. Like, there's like six lines like that in a row. I'm like, why'd you put those lines in there? What are we doing? But
okay, valid as hell.
Again,
no.
Doesn't matter. Because the story is told through action, through visual, through the way scenes are structured and transition from scene to scene. It is all so, like that scene we saw earlier where at the very end where you transition from the phone to Neo's computer, got it. There's some connection there, digital world behind the real world. You get it without it being told to you. And what we're finding again and again on this show is that one of the secret recipes to a great movie is this like teamwork between the movie and the audience. The movie and the audience are united together in a dance, baby. And you're giving me a little bit, but then you're not giving me enough, and you're drawing me on. Mm. You're not standing over my shoulder and telling me and like being like,
"That's why
this is how the Matrix works, and this is what this is."
Welcome to the Matrix.
No, you're just drawing me along, baby. It's a dance. It's poetry. It's me and you, the filmmaker and the audience together, doing it together. Obviously, you did all the work, but I want to be a part of this, baby.
Yeah.
I want to go on a ride. I want to try to figure stuff out. I want to be drawn along. I want to not know everything, but I want to also enjoy the ride. And this movie does that perfectly. And it's also, again, what I think really distinguishes it from the sequels. So many franchises go through this. This is one of the big, I think, examples of a such goodwill coming out of the first one and then just like progressively worse after that. Because much like, you know, Star Wars, when Lucas still had a heavy hand, the creators end up not knowing or forgetting what's good about their own creation.
Justice for the prequels. Do not listen to Brett.
It was the top box office winner from 1999.
Yeah,
The
box office never lies.
Number
one because it's the number one best movie of the year.
Just completely against the very premise of this podcast.
I don't believe that.
Another thing I think that you can say against the Matrix to throw more con out there, and this is a sort of well trod con against the Matrix.
Lay it on.
Is how derivative it is in terms of its sources and its plot, but it's almost so transparently derivative that. Again, it doesn't really matter, and it ultimately is not relying – the things that it is derivative of, it's not relying on those things to be good. And what I'm talking about is Fassbinder's World on a Wire was a huge influence. Grant Morrison's great graphic novel, The Invisibles comic book, The Invisibles – anime, Ghost in the Shell, martial arts movies.
So it had influences.
Jean Baudrillard's Simulation Simulacra, which you see in this movie, you see a copy of it. Yeah. And I read that the Wachowskis made everybody in the movie read Simulation Simulacra,
yes.
which is a difficult, dense, like grad school level theory book.
Good.
Keanu read Simulation Simulacra cover to cover and was into it. So I love it. I love it for you, Keanu.
Totally.
I love Keanu on the subway in New York, circa late 90s, reading Baudrillard. How late night? Nothing more late 90s. Then Keanu on the subway giving up his seat to other people.
Oh, he did. He gave up his seat.
Remember that?
There's
that famous video of him giving up his seat on the subway.
No, but I love
famously
that.
Nice guy. Cyberpunk, William Gibson books like Necromancer.
Sorry, can I? I gotta like.
Everything has influences. This one just.
Yeah, what?
This one just. Well, this one does a very specific thing because everything has influence. Everything comes from something else. This movie does a specific thing that I think can annoy. People in the know, the hipsters, it takes all of these things that are sort of beloved in smaller niche circles and then does a big mainstream watered down version of them. And so I think they're Joe, Joe is wincing in pain. He's at a headache.
If you're on Plus, I'm on
Max
fire.
And Pie style headache. You need the drill?
Not yet. Soon.
So it is a specific type of derivation, though, where it is like taking, like, the Wachowskis were very cool, right? In the know, all the cool shit. They're watching Ghost in the Shell. They're reading The Invisibles. They're reading Cyberpunk, Necromancer. They're watching World on a Wire. And they take all these cool things and mash them together and do a slightly less substantial, watered-down version of it for the masses. There is an argument that that's what The Matrix is doing. I ultimately just don't think it matters because the film, again, cinematic storytelling is so flawless scene by scene. And I also just don't – the reason I like The Matrix is not because of the world itself. The world is cool, but I don't like The Matrix because I'm super into the red pill, blue pill thing or the dynamics of The Matrix or the dynamics of the real world and the robots and all of that. It is just great at the level of movie making. It is just pure, pure cinema. So I ultimately don't think this is a con that matters, but there is an argument to be made.
You know, just a quick thing on the derivative thing. It's like, oh, Kill Bill's great, but The Matrix is derivative.
Yeah.
No, disagree. You know, The Matrix had the wherewithal to watch all those movies and shows and read all those books and draw connections and know and understand that these things will work beautifully together in my storytelling. You know, it's just, you know, I'm just not going to sit here during fucking Pride Month and tell the Wachowskis are fucking derivative. No way. Not here.
Fair enough. Loved The Matrix. Great movie. And much like Jean D'Alma, which I can never watch again.
That's
Matrix
right.
has one color that it likes more than all the other colors.
Now you're just doing songs, not even introducing a segment. You're just going to sing a fucking song. Turn this one up. I'm turning it up in my ears.
It's not blue, though. It's not blue. Matrix doesn't like blue. Close to blue on the spectrum, though. You know what it is. It's green, da 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 ba dee dee. The Matrix is very green, ba da dee ba da da. All the numbers are green, ba da dee ba ba da. And they flow down and down.
Green.
It's green and it's green, and everything is green.
Talk about the fucking derivative.
The next movie that we're looking at from the art house, and oh, it is from the art house, baby. Mm. Deep down in the gritty bowels of the art house. Barely enough money to make this one.
That's
I had to
fun.
Scrape
I love
it
that.
Together.
I love some scrappiness.
Oh, don't waste that film. We don't have enough money for more film.
Mm.
Way down deep in the art house. Pie, the feature film, first feature film from Darren Aronofsky, who has gone on to really shit the bed.
Darren Aronofsky sucks.
He did make
but
Black.
But this movie's great.
He made Black Swan, of course.
Black Swan's great.
He made Noah. He made The Fountain. Requiem for a Dream.
Mother.
He started off very strong. Mother. Mother, may I talk about pie
I'm
right
green,
now?
I'm green.
No green in this movie because it is gritty black and white, baby. It was shot on 16 millimeter. Oh, I love it. Oh, shoot in 16 millimeter again, please. And not just any 16 millimeter, but high contrast black and white reversal 16 millimeter.
Film in that.
Oh, which is you get that all the that high contrast where all the whites are very white, all the darks are very dark. What a
looks
what
really
a
good.
Look! What
I'll
a gritty,
it
gross,
it looks really cool.
grimy look. Oh, the bugs and the slime and his head and his hair and every. Oh,
yeah.
You can feel it all. A very visceral movie, very well made, starring Sean Gillette, Mark Margolis, aka Hector Salamanca, Ben Shankman, great New York theater guy, was in Angels in America, pops up now and again. Things, wonderful actor Ben Shankman.
Come on, Shankman.
This one, it was made for $134,000. You love it. You love to hear it. Just a gritty, gritty little movie. They had to bite and claw to get it made. Darren Aronofsky went around and asked 100 different people for money.
Two of his parents.
Box office, $3.2 million. Not bad. Not bad.
Not
bad, Darren.
That'll get you a Requiem for a Dream, baby.
Won Best Directing Award at the 1998 Sundance Film Festival. Also the Independent Spirit Award for Best First Screenplay.
The what?
Joe, in 60 seconds or less, can you please summarize the plot of Pi? For anyone who hasn't seen it or would love a refresher, go.
Max Cohen is a tortured mathematician who is obsessed with putting his big computer together and he's trying to figure out the stock market. He's like, I can predict the stock market. And everything in life has a pattern, and everything in life is numbers. The birds in the sky, the bees in the nests, everything is numbers. And I can put – if you just get enough numbers over time, you can establish a pattern. So he cracks a way to – do the stock market. Then Wall Street's coming for him saying, I'll give you the
30 seconds.
You give me the analysis. And then some Hasidic Jews are coming for him saying that the Talmud's all numbers. You give me some numbers, I'll give you the Talmud. Anyway, they're both trying to get him on their side.
15 seconds.
But then Max actually figures out this number. It has 216 digits, and he figures out the secret number, and it turns out that that number is the key to God, essentially.
5 seconds.
And everybody wants it, and it's violent, and it's crazy, and he goes crazy, and then he drills himself in the head, but then he's happy.
That's time! Great job.
Thanks, man. You know, great job. Not my best, but also, you know, not my worst.
I think you got it all in there.
I tried. Folks, if that was confusing, press pause and Wikipedia pie.
This movie is pleasantly confusing, though, and it has
not too confusing, though. Not in an annoying way.
Just pleasantly. In the way that I'm like constantly throughout this movie, I'm like, ooh, I gotta read about that. So many times you say it, but without it being annoying, because again, great cinematic storytelling, great action sequences on a low budget in New York, subway, running up and down the stairs
really
of the subway, cramped. They do such a good job showing like a New York apartment that's just stuffed with computer equipment and his computer, which he calls Euclid, which is doing all the equations, and this little stock ticker that's kind of been, rigged together. So just, again, great cinematic storytelling, but I love a movie that is unapologetically information heavy, intellectual information. You're gonna get a lot of stuff going on. We're gonna talk about Joe is not so sure, but it does. I think it works well. I think this is how you do it. This is how you do it because there's
fun movie.
There's enthusiasm in it. There's the enthusiasm of youth, of a young filmmaker. It's not an old filmmaker being like, I'm gonna tell you guys what's really going on here. It's a young filmmaker who just can't not tell you all these things. There's an enthusiasm. There's a youthfulness. You're learning about, again, like Joe said, you're learning about Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, numerology in the Torah.
It's derivative of the Torah. It's derivative of Euclid. It's derivative of the Pythagorean theorem.
You're learning about numbers theory
and the
golden ratio and the numbers and the systems that unite us and nature and the stock market and religion and everything. It is a heady movie. But it also is kind of a horror movie. It's kind of a thriller. It's doing great things with the camera. It's doing fun things with character. It is. I'm proud of this movie. It's like the best student film you've ever seen.
It. And this is not a dig, but it has a really nice student film energy to it, and it has all the energy and excitement of a student, someone who cannot believe they've gotten that money, and they're gonna use it every last inch to make their dreams come true. And you know he's young because he's shooting in this crazy black and white and everything's shaky and he's shooting on 16 millimeter
oh,
and
love
he's
it.
Just so like full to the brim with just exuberance and joie de vivre.
Well said.
He's, you know, this isn't Aronofsky, you know, with Noah. This isn't Aronofsky with Mother. Just been run through he starts overthinking it all, yeah. And he gets so into himself because he made $3.2 million on fucking Pi.
This isn't Aronofsky and showing up late to set wearing a baseball hat for a team he doesn't even root for.
But he's late because he was up all night
texting with J-Law. Storyboards.
This is it. This is the movie.
This is real fucking deal, gritty ass storytelling. I wish it had made like $750,000. Keep him hungry. Keep Aronofsky hungry, yeah. Baby. Yeah, Something to prove.
But no,
it was a big fucking Sundance hit, blah, blah, blah. Then he gets to make Requiem for a Dream and have Jared Leto chop his damn arm off and Ellen Burstyn almost win an Oscar. Did she win an Oscar? She almost won an Oscar.
You're wondering, Joe, do you like Black Swan? I do like Black Swan.
Nobody asked that.
But otherwise, you know, this is his best. This is his best film by a country mile because he... isn't sure of who he is yet, and when he does mature and he learns who he is, he stinks. But at this point, he could have gone in any direction, so there's lots of different ways he could have gone. And the movie is exciting. It also deals with kind of like that, just like The Matrix, it reminds me, it has this conspiratorial, I can figure it out sort of mentality where you're along for the ride with Max, and if he could just put all the pieces together and he can pull from all these cool disparate sources that all the numbers and like the code of the world will be revealed. And it is. He sort of goes into his own, real world red pills himself. He finds out these digits where God reveals himself in these numbers and the whole world makes sense, much like in Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull when Cate Blanchett, sees God. It's like that for Max, you know,
heretical. It's a heretical comparison. Yeah.
Oh, what?
Just heretic. It was heresy.
We'll do Crystal Skull on this podcast We'll do Crystal Skull.
Ellen Burstyn did not win the Academy Award for Requiem Dream. She was nominated, though. She's won once for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and she's been nominated, count them, 6 times, baby.
Shout out to Ellen. Anyway,
let's watch that scene. Okay. You can keep talking. I'm going to cue up the scene at the very end with the rabbis, he's been talking with one of the rabbi's assistants throughout the movie, Ben Shankman, at the diner. And Ben Shankman's been sort of, in a way, kind of grooming him along for this big... That word is impossible to use now.
We're laughing because Brett's in a Twitter spat with whatever. I don't know.
Whatever. Got a little spat with the CEO of the Babylon Bee, that wonderful the Onion
just
for the alt
right. Just tons of media.
Yeah.
Just like it's a Godzilla versus Kong over on Brett's Twitter. Just the CEO of the Babylon Bee.
Do you love the Onion, but it just isn't hateful enough for you?
Or unfunny enough.
Or unfunny. Oh, God, it's so unfunny. Yeah. It's not even trying to be funny anymore.
We all know, like, the right, like, it's key. Like, only Trump ever did it. But, like in theory, like, you could be funny. This is devoid of comedy. This is
it's not even the goal anymore.
No, it's insane.
So anyway, the topic of the week for the far right is saying that drag queens are pedophiles, blah blah blah, bullshit, whatever. Of course it is. So I took a little shot at the Babylon Bee CEO on Twitter about this. He retweeted me with just a bizarre retweet. But then, of course, predictably, I was flooded with my mentions were flooded with all of his followers calling me a groomer and a pedophile because I stood up for drag queens and said,
we tittered like school children.
Rat, you fucking sewer chud. Take their goddamn name out of your mouth. Look, I don't even remember your Seth something. I don't even remember
fucking
your name.
Cares.
Fuck you. Em. Fuck you. Fuck and fuck the Babylon Bee.
Babylon Bee's not funny.
Drag queens rule. You have to live with, you have to be you. What a horrible thing to be, being you. You fucking vermin. Let's watch that scene at the end with the rabbis. Like I was saying, he's been led along by one of the rabbi's assistants who's sort of slowly parsed out information. Oh, you do numbers. I do numbers too. I do numbers, you know, ancient Jewish mysticism, Torah, numbers.
It's slow.
And then you find out what the big play is in this scene. One second.
Max. Max. Max.
Just great low budget filmmaking.
You're all right.
Just it's play so with cool. play with things like low shot. Angle, high angle, play with compositions.
It's so exciting.
It's free, baby. Like you. Guess what's free?
The contrast, low angle. The contrast sorry, between the white and the black and how oversaturated the film is yes. is really exciting. It's and not. It really fits into the paranoia okay? and fear of Max's character and how like how his eyes, remember the whole motif of him looking into the sun Max. And how that affected him and how that you led him down this specific path.
Yeah, you see all the high contrast, in the filmmaking. The high contrast makes you see it through is Max's it? Eyes because everything seems sort of, you feel like your eyes are off the whole movie. You're seeing things too brightly or too
the tunnel
darkly.
Tells
or,
us it began 2,000 years ago when the Romans destroyed the Second Temple.
Oh, what is
like
this?
It's like Max, fucking heaven when they, get, when they go into these monologues.
Yeah, this part's so fun. This is like, yeah. You know, like network-esque.
The Romans also destroyed our priesthood, the Kohanim. And with their deaths, they destroyed our greatest secret.
This rabbi convinced me.
In
I'm like, give it to
the
him.
Temple was the heart of the Jewish
give it to
life,
him.
The Holy of Holies.
This competition is so, this composition is so good.
It's so
this
cool.
This is a painting. This is like a Rembrandt painting.
$136,000, $60,000 of which was to make the movie, $68,000 of which was 63,000 of which was to edit the movie.
Because again, I can't say
enough. $60,000.
You know what's free? Tilting the camera. You know what's free? Arranging
going
your
to the local Jewish community center and asking the rabbis and the assembled the assembled congregants to be in your film.
These are professional actors.
They are not free. To watch the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, make his trip into the Holy of Holies. If the high
oh, and that just drone
pure,
in the background. Oh my
he would
God.
Emerge
the
moments
good,
later,
man.
And we were secured a prosperous year. It meant that we were 1 year closer to the Messianic age.
It's also all those things you said about the late 90s skateboard kids all bought a computer, punk rock ethos of post
edgelord.
Post
not quite punk
America.
Rock, a little more goth than punk rock.
Yeah, yeah, that totally gothy thing is all it's all here and it's in that musical open. Yes. Very, very.
If you were that, yeah, if you were that person. And you were a sophomore in high school, you were all about The Matrix. If you were that person
if
and
I
you were
this movie
you were
a sophomore,
sophomore
in
college
high,
right now, yeah. you were all about Pi. I think this is like, Pi was like The Matrix if you were kind of already...
Yeah. If you were a sophomore in college,
because I could see
Pi's
I could see you falling out of love of The Matrix when you go through your pretentious like college phase,
of
and then
course.
Coming and then falling back in love with it when you're an adult and you're like,
that,
oh, I just
that,
want a good movie, baby. I just want a good
that's
movie.
That's what happened
like,
to me. Yes. I thought I was too cool for The Matrix at one point in my life.
It can take us one step closer to the Garden
Dude,
of Eden.
Max is like, can I
as the
go?
Romans burned the temple, the Talmud tells us the high priest.
He's like, I have no
flames.
Idea what you're talking about.
He took the key to the top of the burning building. The heavens opened and received the key from the.
There is some interesting stuff here about how numbers, everything gets exploited by higher powers. Like, yes. Max has an ability. He has an ability to get to the bottom of numbers, to get to the bottom of codes. Wall Street wants his ass. Religion wants his ass. Everybody wants a piece of Max's ass because he can get to the bottom of the numbers, baby. He can
he
hack
did.
Into the
at,
system
at this
for
point,
you.
He has the number.
God. No.
And he's hiding it. He's keeping
he knows
it from
it.
Them.
He has the name of God.
See God unless you are pure.
I love his person.
Everything.
I love
you saw nothing, only a glimpse. So much more. We can use the key to unlock the door. We can show God that we are pure again. He will return.
You're not
us.
Pure. How are you pure? I found it.
Do you think you are? You are only a vessel from our God. You are carrying a delivery that was meant for us.
It was given
presumptive.
To me.
Yeah, I agree with me. Actually, Max is right. Yeah,
it's
relax.
It's inside of me.
Whoa.
It's changing me.
It's killing you.
Okay, good point.
Because you are not ready to receive it.
He's going like fucking crazy, guys. In the bathroom, he's like squishing his brain in the sink, and he's spinning around like a lunatic. And his landlord's coming in, kicking him out.
I'm sure you've written down every 216-digit number. You've translated all of them. You've intoned them all, haven't you? What's it gotten you? The number is nothing. It's the meaning.
Cool.
The syntax.
Good writing. Good movie.
It's between the numbers.
It's fun. It's fun. It's like a little puzzle.
If you haven't understood it, it's because it's not for you.
Ooh.
I've got it. I got it, and I understand it, and I'm gonna see it, Rabbi, I was chosen. 1713.
Great, great scene.
It is a great scene.
And it has, again, great cinematic storytelling because so much information is given to us. I find the information very interesting. But at the end, you are able to walk away from that scene, regardless of all the information about the Holy of Holies and the Sanctum Sanctorum and the temple and the you know, Tetragrammaton, the name of God, all this stuff. You're able to walk away from that scene with a very simple theme, which is the recurring theme of the movie, which is the pursuit of knowledge, the pursuit of the meaning of it all. Is there any end to that, right? Wall Street wants there to be an end to it, them getting rich. Religion wants there to be an end to it. The name of God, the key to heaven, et cetera, heaven on earth, the return of this and that. But what Max's mentor knows and what he finds out is there is no end to it. The meaning of it all, like he says, between the numbers, it is the act of decoding, the act of pursuing the truth. But there is no, you know, we talk about Baudrillard, to bring in a little Derrida here.
Do it.
There is no ultimate sort of, you know, we live in a very logocentric age, as Derrida would say, where there was a people believed in a in a final truth that everything was pointing to, like one pinpoint of light at which everything converged upon and there was an answer. Whereas what Derrida knew, what Max knows, is that it's always in the interplay between the numbers, between the words, that meaning is in the in-between spaces and the movement between numbers and words. There is no ultimate answer. There is no ultimate truth. And that's why Max puts a damn drill to his head and says, free me from all of it, baby. I just want to sit in the park and stare at the goddamn sun.
Cool. I mean, honestly, like, well said. That sounds, I mean, that really kind of, that folks, that was evocative of Pi. You know, I'm not going to, like, follow that up with me repeating what Brett said. That's true. That's what Aronofsky's getting at. It was a wonderful distillation. You know what? Even the Derrida thing didn't bother me. Normally, I'd be like, dude, shut the fuck up. But honestly, like, yeah, okay. The journey is the destination.
I had to check my facts here. Logocentrism, defined as a philosophy holding that all forms of thought are based on an external point of reference, which is held to exist and given a certain degree of authority. So yeah, I think I was right on that.
Dude, you know how fucking attuned my Derrida fucking alarm is? It would have been blaring if anything was off. But to me,
it stayed dormant.
It stayed dormant, and I was able to just ride with you, and I loved it. To which, so basically what I want to say to you is, good job describing Pi. I agree with you.
I love Pi. I love The Matrix. Now it comes to
What do you think about Pi, the dessert? Are you a pie guy or a cake guy?
Which one is into the trash cannon?
Heavy
pies in the trash cannon, light fluffy pies in the cannon. Your key limes, your coconut cream, cannon all day, baby. Specifically key lime. That's the top of the goddamn pie mountain for me.
Okay, you're a key lime guy.
I can kick my feet up, pretend I'm in the keys, baby. Me and Hemingway cake? Drinking some rum, but I'll blow our brains out on the goddamn boat, baby.
Where do you stand on cake?
Not a fan. No, too heavy, right. Too sweet.
Pie cannon, cake, trash cannon.
Oh, if those are the choices, pie cannon, cake, trash
cannon. Pie cannon, cake, trash cannon.
I would like to further distinguish heavy pies, trash cannon.
I like that. I disagree.
Apples, you're like,
oh, I love them.
Big, thick, put ice cream on top of it. I'm only human, baby. I can't eat all that. Give me a key lime. Give me a sweet little fluffy key lime.
All right. All right, the movie. I'm sorry, but I digress.
Now's the time of the show. Very difficult choice this week. We have to pick between Pi and The Matrix. Which one is going in the canon? Which one is going in the trash cannon? Another week where I wish there was other categories, but there aren't. We're staying true to our premise.
Yeah, you got to stay true. And the premise is we just put two movies next to each other and... We ask this question, and there's no real. I mean, there's rhyme and reason. Like, there's obviously similarities. We've just fucked ourselves. There's no reason that one of these movies should be in something called the trash can. And this happens every week. These are good movies.
There's a great Ethan Hawke clip going around a while ago. We're going to do an Ethan Hawke episode in a couple weeks. But there was a great clip going around.
God, I'm going to praise Ethan
Hawke.
Where
he was like breaking down the dichotomy between mainstream and art house and like exploding.
I love him.
all the myths around that, which is what we do on this show. And I was like, yeah, baby, Ethan's a Bergman's head. He's a Weekend Bergman's head. He's doing this. But then at the very end, he's like, and the worst thing is like, why are we always making films like compete with each other? Why are we always putting films in a competition? And I was like, hey, oh, yeah.
You know why, Ethan? Because that's our job. It's here fucking at fun, Weekend baby. At Bergman's. It's our job.
It's
okay.
Fucking fun.
Brett, which one are you going to put in all the right. can and which one are you going to put in the trash
can? At the
cannon?
End of the day, it put up a noble fight. It has all the energy of youth.
It was such a movie
again that I'm so proud of. I love so much. I'm glad I got to see it one last time. I'm sending pie to the trash cannon. I'm sorry, baby. You put up a good fight, but you can't beat The Matrix. I got to put The Matrix in the cannon. That's an all-timer for me. An all-timer in the world of mainstream filmmaking. I ain't no simpleton. I was just quoting goddamn Derrida. I love art house movies. Oh, the Lord. Matrix is peak mainstream filmmaking. The best of the best,
yeah,
baby.
It's like Die Hard level.
Oh, it is so good. Matrix goes in the cannon for me. Pie, sadly, goes in the trash cannon, but I will remember you fondly, baby. Yep. Oh, that high contrast black and white 16 mm-hmm. millimeter mm-hmm. talking to me about mm-hmm. Jewish mysticism mm-hmm. and number theory.
I do like the Jewish mysticism bit of yes. Pie so much. I like Pie a lot.
Joe.
When I was walking around the Blockbuster in the late 90s, I remember seeing these Aronofskys and thinking like, oh, this guy, like, Pie, you know, it was right next to like yeah. movies like yeah. Magnolia or like yeah. a David Lynch film, and it was next to like, you know, your Cronenbergs, and I was like, oh wait, this guy, he's another one of these guys I gotta check
yeah.
out. And then I watched Requiem for a Dream and I was like, you know, I don't know, I was like in high school, so I bet there was a period of time where I was
the
like,
the last cool. of like the gritty New York auteurs yeah. before he went mainstream. Yeah.
But anyway, Pie, yeah. I remember Pie being on the shelf, and for whatever reason, I don't know, it was the only movie I didn't rent in the Blockbuster, but I never got around to it. This is the first time I've ever seen this movie.
Wow.
And I've seen The Matrix like four like legitimate times, like four like full sit downs, stone cold sobers. I'm watching The Matrix. I've seen The Matrix. So The Matrix.
I'm on the edge of my seat right now.
So The Matrix, you know, I knew it. I thought I knew it really well. But it still has so much more to
That's
show me.
That's what I thought. Yeah,
it has so much
I know,
more to show
I know,
me.
I know.
And Pi,
yeah.
I watched it. I liked it. It's good. And you know what? And God bless it. It's an hour and 20 minutes, which you always have to tip cap to the people that keep your movies nice and tight. It's very exciting. It's full of life. It's a lot of fun things going on. A great first film. Very impressive. Maybe Aronofsky's best. We'll have to rewatch Black Swan on this podcast, which is a fun one, in my
opinion. Pie's going to be hard to beat. Pie's going to be
really Pie's really good. The Matrix, I liked it more, and it is better.
That's what we'll do, though. I think we go ahead and commit to this now. Matrix is better. Matrix goes into the canon. We liked Matrix more. We're being honest.
This is a stupid
exercise.
I'm
willing to pledge right now. Okay. We've teased this before. Yeah. One day down the road,
when we pull,
we'll bring bring Pie out of the trash can and give it one more shot at glory, and we'll put it up against a Aronofsky mainstream movie.
Okay,
maybe Black Swan.
Black Swan versus Pie.
Yes.
So it's like you have to cut off, you have to put some blood in the trash can
exactly.
and get something out.
Exactly.
Okay, I like that. I am also convinced that one day we'll do like we each get to like rescue something, but then it has to fight something
that's
from
fun.
The
can.
You know, stuff like that's coming, folks. Pie will be one of them, one of the ones in the trash can that's wallowing, and me and Brett might have to go save it. But you know, Jean Dalman's in there as well, and that one might have to get saved first. But you know, that's a different
green.
Conversation.
Well, at least I got one green movie.
A
in the
different
canon.
Conversation for another day. Pie's good. It's got a lot of fun stuff. I really liked it.
Look, what we're gonna do
but
to Pie?
The Matrix.
Is, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm just repeating myself.
We're gonna take
it's
Pie over to the side of the room, which is Pie.
Pie, look out! Look
you
out!
You did
yonder.
Such a good job. You
look
got
out yonder,
so much.
Pie.
You have so much potential. You have so much potential, Pie. It's the beginning
good.
Of a long life for you. You're gonna do so many good things. Now just look. Now just turn around. Look off into the distance, Pie.
Yeah,
and just think.
Millennium.
Just think
yeah,
of.
Give me a.
Just think of your future and hope and
him.
The numbers. Think of the numbers, Pie. Think of the numbers and getting to the bottom.
Everything's
of
numbers.
Numbers flying
give it to him.
By you, baby.
Give it
They're
to
flying
him.
By
give
you.
It to him.
Become one with the numbers, Pie.
Pie me.
I love you, Pie.
Wow. Oh, poor Pie. No, Pie's blissful now. Pie's in a better place. Remember at the end of the movie, Max, he's sitting there on the bench. I think maybe that is why it's in the trash can. And at the end, Max is sitting on the bench and a little girl says, "Hey, Max, do the trick where I do 1,000 plus, 244.
Hey, Max, what's 587 times 17 divided by 48?
She's like, do 70 times 6. And he's like, "I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one."
And he
never and then he smiles and he looks up at the trees. And I said, "Okay."
But he remembers knowing. He remembers when he knew.
Now, the real question is Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull going to go in the cannon
next
or the trash
week,
cannon?
Next week, we are looking at two movies. Ooh, we're staying in the Big Apple, baby.
What's next?
We're looking at two movies all about the sort of the mythical status of New York and a city where strivers come to and they try to climb that old ladder of success with varying degrees of success. We are going to be watching The Sweet Smell of Success. Sorry, just Sweet Smell of Success. Great film from a period that I love that I'm going to talk a little bit about. That inner period between, the studio system had collapsed. We're into the late 40s, 50s, but we haven't gotten to full-on new Hollywood, transgressive, Easy Rider-style filmmaking yet.
I can't wait for
that. You get so many weird little movies in that window of time, and I fucking love them.
Yeah, you're right.
Sweet Smell of Success with Burt Lancaster, Tony Curtis. We're going to watch that versus the Michael J. Fox vehicle, The Secret of My Success, which if you were a person of my age, was on TV, the Turner channels in particular, TBS, TNT, quite a lot
growing up. I love Michael J. Fox, Brett.
And so I will say right now, and I'll say it again next week, and once again, we're going to watch these with fresh eyes.
I love Tony Curtis, Brett.
We're going to watch these with fresh eyes, so there's no this context doesn't matter ultimately, but Sweet Smell Success, one of my all-time favorite movies.
Oh, come on.
So hard to beat. Such a good movie. Secret of My Success, I've got a lot of nostalgia for. Watched it a lot growing up. As a little boy in Georgia, it filled my head with dreams of the big city and what could be accomplished there. What will win out? My heart or my brain next week.
I wonder what it's, sometimes it's hard to go back to those old favorites, but sometimes it's also a treat. So we'll have to see. I've never seen either film.
You've never seen Secret of My, you've never seen Sweet Smell of Success?
Nah, I have.
Okay. We might also be joined by a special guest next week.
Stephen Root?
Maybe Stephen Root is going to wander back in here.
But also another guest.
Honestly, Joe was thinking, he told me later, he was like, if Stephen hangs on for a couple of minutes, I'm going to pitch him to be on this episode.
Because if he went, it's tomorrow. Oh, man. I had planned to do, I had the next hour and a half to do a podcast.
I really want to do a podcast.
Have you seen Pi and the Matrix? And he'd say, yeah, of course. I'm Stephen Root. I've been in the biz for longer than you've been born, Sonny Boy.
Sit down,
Jim.
Steve.
Steve, throw on
like,
this.
Have I seen the Matrix?
And let Brett drill you in the chest and write all over it. You're in a week in a freaking
Have
Bergman's
I seen
now.
The Matrix? I was in the running for Neo.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be, you know who was in the running? You know, the original casting? This is so good. Wait, I've got to get this right.
Will Smith?
Will Smith was supposed to be Neo. He turned it down for Wild Wild West.
A friend of the pod.
How could we have known?
Joe Silver, who will be a guest later, a wonderful film critic and scientist out of New York. Silver would say that he made the right choice. Big
Wild Wild West fan?
Massive Wild Wild West guy.
Can I propose Wild Wild West and the Wild Bunch?
You can pitch me Bergman's all day and I'll nod my head.
Okay, all right. This is very interesting. Original casting for The Matrix, Will Smith as Neo, Val Kilmer as Morpheus. Chew on that. What could
That'd
have been?
Better.
What could have been?
It would have, look,
what it was
we
great.
Loved what, it was like, it was like a 95, 94, 95. Could have been a 96, 97 if we had the Will Smith, Val Kilmer.
Don't mess with success. There's always alternate histories to cycle through, but why waste? We have this history we haven't gotten to the bottom of this history. Numbers flying past our heads, incels running around everywhere. Joe, it was a pleasure as always.
That was fun. I wish I don't want it to end, but it has to. That's just good. You can follow us at Weekend Bergmans. And folks, I hope to see you this weekend at the double feature. Check it out. We're talking Crimes of the Future. We're talking about Top Gun Maverick. I want to hear your thoughts. Send them to Brett's DM or retweet them and call him a dirty groomer.
Follow us. Yes.
Just kidding. Don't do that. Instead, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.
About a little guy that lives in the blue world, and all And his name is Neo, and he looks at the computer screen, and he's figuring it out, and he's going to the club, and he's partying at the club, and I think he does party at the club that night because he wakes up in the morning late as though he's had a big night. So we have a missing night from Neo. We have a missing night from Neo where he was going hard at the club. And you know what the color of the club was? It was green, da-ba-dee-ba-ba-da, because everything is green, and the numbers are green. And, of course, the club, it has to be green, and Neo is green, dancing in the green light at the club. And he throws up, and the throw-up, it's green, and it goes in the toilet, and the toilet is green, and the streets are green, and the sky is green, and the Matrix is green, and Jean Delman is green, but I cannot watch it anymore, because it's in the trash can.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.